I'm a friend. I advanced a step towards him. I offered you my help once. I offer it again. Will you have it? The fierceness of his answer took me aback.
No, I'll have no truck with you or with any woman. Do your damnedest.
As before, my own temper began to rise. Perhaps, I said, you don't realise how much in my power you are. A word from me to the captain.
Say it, he sneered,
then advanced with a quick step.
And whilst we're realising things, my dear girl, do you realise you're in my power this minute? I could take you by the throat like this.
With a swift gesture, he suited the action to the word. I felt his two hands clasp my throat and press ever so little.
Like this. And squeeze the life out of you. And then, like your unconscious friend here, but with more success, fling your dead body to the sharks. What do you say to that?
I said nothing. I laughed. And yet I knew that the danger was real. Just at that moment he hated me. But I knew that I loved the danger, loved the feeling of his hands on my throat, that I would not have exchanged the moment for any moment in my life. With a short laugh, he released me.
What's your name? He asked abruptly.
Anne Bedingfeld.
Does nothing frighten you, Anne Bedingfeld?
Oh, yes, I said, with an assumption of coolness I was far from feeling. Wasps, sarcastic women, very young men, cockroaches and superior shop assistants.
He gave the same short laugh as before. Then he stirred the unconscious form of Paget with his feet. What shall we do with this junk? Throw it overboard? He asked carelessly.
If you like, I answered with equal calm.
I admire your wholehearted bloodthirsty instincts, Miss Bedingfeld, but we will leave him to recover at his leisure. He's not seriously hurt.
You shrink from a second murder, I see, I said sweetly.
A second murder?
He looked genuinely puzzled. The woman at Marlowe, I reminded him, watching the effects of my words closely. An ugly, brooding expression settled down on his face. He seemed to have forgotten my presence.
I might have killed her, he said. Sometimes I believe that I meant to kill her.
A wild rush of feeling, hatred of the dead woman, surged through me. I could have killed her at that moment, had she stood before me. For he must have loved her once. He must, to have felt like that. I regained control of myself and spoke in my normal voice. We seem to have said all there is to be said, except good night.
Good night and goodbye, Miss Bedingfeld.
Au revoir, Mr. Lucas.
Again he flinched at the name. He came nearer. Why do you say that? Au revoir, I mean.
Because I have a fancy that we shall meet again.
Not if I can help it.
Emphatic as his tone was, it did not offend me. On the contrary, I hugged myself with secret satisfaction. I'm not quite a fool. All the same, I said gravely, I think we shall.
Why?
I shook my head, unable to explain the feeling that had actuated my words.
I never wish to see you again, he said suddenly, and violently.
It was really a very rude thing to say, but I only laughed softly and slipped away into the darkness. I heard him start after me and then pause. A word floated down the deck. I think it was witch.
Chapter 17. Extract from the diary of Sir Eustace Pedler.
Mount Nelson Hotel, Cape Town. It is really the greatest relief to get off the Kilmorden. The whole time that I was on board, I was conscious of being surrounded by a network of intrigue. To put the lid on everything, Guy Paget must needs engage in a drunken brawl the last night. It is all very well to explain it away, but that is what it actually amounts to. What else would you think if a man comes to you with a lump the size of an egg on the side of his head and an eye coloured all the tints of the rainbow? Of course, Paget would insist on trying to be mysterious about the whole thing. According to him, you would think his black eye was the direct result of his devotion to my interests. His story was extraordinarily vague and rambling, and it was a long time before I could make head or tail of it. To begin with, it appears he caught sight of a man behaving suspiciously. Those are Paget's words. He has taken them straight from the pages of a German spy story. What he means by a man behaving suspiciously, he doesn't know himself. I said so to him. He was slinking along in a very furtive manner, and it was the middle of the night, Sir Eustace. Well, What were you doing yourself? Why weren't you in bed and asleep like a good Christian? I demanded irritably.
I had been coding those cables of yours, Sir Eustace, and typing the diary up to date.
Trust Paget to be always in the right, and a martyr over it.
Well? I just thought I would have a look round before turning in, Sir Eustace. The man was coming down the passage from your cabin. I thought at once there was something wrong by the way he looked about him. He slunk up the stairs by the saloon. I followed him.
My dear Paget, I said, why shouldn't the poor chap go on deck without having his footsteps dogged? Lots of people even sleep on deck. Very uncomfortable, I always thought. The sailors wash you down with the rest of the deck at 5 in the morning. I shuddered at the idea. Anyway, I continued, if you went worrying some poor devil who was suffering from insomnia, I don't wonder he landed you one.
Paget looked patient. If you would hear me out, Sir Eustace, I was convinced the man had been prowling about near your cabin, where we had no business to be. The only two cabins down that passage are yours and Colonel Race's.
Race, I said, lighting a cigar carefully, can look after himself without your assistance, Paget. I added as an afterthought, so can I.
Paget came nearer and breathed heavily as he always does before imparting a secret.
You see, Sir Eustace, I fancied, and now indeed I am sure, it was Raeburn.
Raeburn?
Yes, Sir Eustace.
I shook my head. Raeburn has far too much sense to attempt to wake me up in the middle of the night.
Quite so, Sir Eustace. I think it was Colonel Race he went to see. A secret meeting. For orders.
Don't hiss at me, Paget, I said, drawing back a little. And do control your breathing. Your idea is absurd. Why should they want to have a secret meeting in the middle of the night? If they'd anything to say to each other, they could hobnob over beef tea in a perfectly casual and natural manner. I could see that Paget was not in the least convinced.
Something was going on last night, Sir Eustace, he urged. Or why should Raeburn assault me so brutally?
You're quite sure it was Raeburn?
Paget appeared to be perfectly convinced of that. It was the only part of the story that he wasn't vague about.
There's something very queer about all this, he said.
To begin with, where is Raeburn?
It's perfectly true that we haven't seen the fellow since we came ashore. He did not come up to the hotel with us. I decline to believe that he is afraid of Paget, however. Although the whole thing is very annoying. One of my secretaries has vanished into the blue, and the other looks like a disreputable prize-fighter. I can't take him about with me in his present condition. I shall be the laughing-stock of Cape Town. I have an appointment later in the day to deliver old Milray's billet-doux, but I shall not take Paget with me. Confound the fellow in his prowling ways. Although I am decidedly out of temper, I had a poisonous breakfast with poisonous people, Dutch waitresses with thick ankles who took half an hour to bring me a bad bit of fish, and this farce of getting up at 5 a.m. on arrival at the port to see a blinking doctor and hold your hands above your head simply makes me tired. Later. A very serious thing has occurred. I went to my appointment with the Prime Minister, taking Milray's sealed letter. It didn't look as though it had been tampered with, but inside was a blank sheet of paper. Now I suppose I'm in the devil of a mess. Why I ever let that bleating old fool Milray embroil me in the matter, I can't think. Paget is a famous Job's comforter. He displays a certain gloomy satisfaction that maddens me. Also, he has taken advantage of my perturbation to saddle me with the stationery trunk. Unless he is careful, the next funeral he attends will be his own. However, in the end, I had to listen to him.
Supposing, Sir Eustace, that Raeburn had overheard a word or two of your conversation with Mr. Milray in the street. Remember, you had no written authority from Mr. Milray. You accepted Raeburn on his own valuation.
You think Raeburn is a crook, then? I said slowly.
Paget did. How far his views were influenced by resentment over his black eye, I don't know. He made out a pretty fair case against Raeburn, and the appearance of the latter told against him. My idea was to do nothing in the matter. A man who has permitted himself to be made a thorough fool of is not anxious to broadcast the fact. But Paget, his energy unimpaired by his recent misfortunes, was all for vigorous measures. He had his way, of course. He bustled out to the police station, sent innumerable cables, and brought a herd of English and Dutch officials to drink whiskies and sodas at my expense. We got Milray's answer that evening. He knew nothing of my late secretary. There was only one spot of comfort to be extracted from the situation. At any rate, I said to Paget, you weren't poisoned. You had one of your ordinary bilious attacks. I saw him wince. It was my only score. Later. Paget is in his element. His brain positively scintillates with bright ideas. He still will have it now that Rayburn is none other than the famous man in the brown suit. I dare say he is right. He usually is. But all this is getting unpleasant. The sooner I get off to Rhodesia, the better. I have explained to Paget that he is not to accompany me. You see, my dear fellow, I said, you must remain here on the spot. You might be required to identify Rayburn any minute. And besides, I have my dignity as an English Member of Parliament to think of. I can't go about with a secretary who has apparently recently been indulging in a vulgar street brawl. Paget winced. He is such a respectable fellow that his appearance is pain and tribulation to him. But what will you do about your correspondence and the notes for your speeches, Sir Eustace? I shall manage, I said airily. Your private car is to be attached to the 11 o'clock train tomorrow, Wednesday morning, Paget continued. I have made all arrangements. Is Mrs. Blair taking a maid with her? Mrs. Blair? I gasped. She tells me you offered her a place. So I did, now I come to think of it, on the night of the fancy dress ball. I even urged her to come, but I never thought she would. Delightful as she is, I do not know that I want Mrs. Blair's society all the way to Rhodesia and back. Women require such a lot of attention, and they are confoundedly in the way sometimes. Have I asked anyone else? I said nervously. One does these things in moments of expansion. Mrs. Blair seems to think you had asked Colonel Race as well. I groaned. I must have been very drunk if I asked Race. Very drunk indeed. Take my advice, Paget, and let your black eye be a warning to you. Don't go on the bust again. As you know, I am a teetotaler, Sir Eustace. Much wiser to take the pledge if you have a weakness that way. I haven't asked anyone else, have I, Paget? Not that I know of, Sir Eustace. I heaved a sigh of relief. There's Miss Bedingfeld, I said thoughtfully. She wants to get to Rhodesia to dig up bones, I believe. I've a good mind to offer her a temporary job as a secretary. She can typewrite, I know, for she told me so. To my surprise, Paget opposed the idea vehemently. He does not like Anne Bedingfeld. Ever since the night of the black eye, he has displayed uncontrollable emotion whenever she is mentioned. Paget is full of mysteries nowadays. Just to annoy him, I shall ask the girl. As I said before, she has extremely nice legs.
Chapter 18. Anne's narrative resumed. I don't suppose that as long as I live I shall forget my first sight of Table Mountain. I got up frightfully early and went out on deck. I went right up to the boat deck, which I believe is a heinous offence. But I decided to dare something in the cause of solitude. We were just steaming into Table Bay. There were fleecy white clouds hovering above Table Mountain, and nestling on the slopes below, right down to the sea, was the sleeping town, gilded and bewitched by the morning sunlight. It made me catch my breath and have that curious hungry pain inside that seizes one sometimes when one comes across something that's extra beautiful. I'm not very good at expressing these things, but I knew well enough that I had found, if only for a fleeting moment, the thing that I had been looking for ever since I left Little Hamsley. Something new, something hitherto undreamed of, something that satisfied my aching hunger for romance. Perfectly silently, or so it seemed to me, the Kilmorden glided nearer and nearer. It was still very like a dream. Like all dreamers, however, I could not let my dream alone. We poor humans are so anxious not to miss anything. This is South Africa, I kept saying to myself industriously. South Africa, South Africa. You are seeing the world. This is the world. You are seeing it. Think of it, Anne Bedingfeld, you pudding head. You're seeing the world. I had thought that I had the boat deck to myself, but now I observed another figure leaning over the rail, absorbed as I had been in the rapidly approaching city. Even before he turned his head, I knew who it was. The scene of last night seemed unreal and melodramatic in the peaceful morning sunshine. What must he have thought of me? It made me hot to realize the things that I had said, and I hadn't meant them. Or had I? I turned my head resolutely away and stared hard at Table Mountain. If Rayburn had come up here to be alone, I at least need not disturb him by advertising my presence. But to my intense surprise, I heard a light footfall on the deck behind me, and then his voice, pleasant and normal.
"Miss Bedingfeld?"
"Yes," I turned.
"I want to apologize to you. I behaved like a perfect bore last night."
It was a peculiar night," I said hastily.
It was not a very lucid remark,
but it was absolutely the only thing I could think of.
"Will you forgive me?"
I held out my hand without a word. He took it.
"There's something else I want to say."
His gravity deepened.
"Miss Bedingfeld, you may not know it, but you are mixed up in a rather dangerous business."
"I gather as much," I said.
"No, you don't. You can't possibly know. I want to warn you. Leave the whole thing alone. It can't concern you, really. Don't let your curiosity lead you to tamper with other people's business. No, please don't get angry again. I'm not speaking of myself. You've no idea what you might come up against. These men will stop at nothing. They're absolutely ruthless. Already you're in danger. Look at last night. They fancy you know something. Your only chance is to persuade them that they're mistaken. But be careful. Always be on the lookout for danger. And look here, if at any time you should fall into their hands, don't try and be clever. Tell the whole truth. It will be your only chance."
"You make my flesh creep, Mr. Rayburn," I said with some truth. "Why do you take the trouble to warn me?"
He did not answer for some minutes, and then he said in a low voice, "It may be the last thing I can do for you. Once on shore, I shall be all right, but I may not get on shore."
"What?" I cried.
"You see, I'm afraid you're not the only person on board who knows that I am the man in the brown suit."
"If you think that I told," I said hotly. He reassured me with a smile.
"I don't doubt you, Miss Bedingfeld. If I ever said I did, I lied." "No, but there's one person on board who's known all along. He's only to speak, and my number's up. All the same, I'm taking a sporting chance that he won't speak."
"Why?"
"Because he's a man who likes playing a lone hand. And when the police have got me, I should be of no use to him. Free, I might be. Well, an hour will show."
He laughed rather mockingly. But I saw his face harden. If he had gambled with fate, he was a good gambler. He could lose and smile.
"In any case," he said lightly, "I don't suppose we shall meet again."
"No," I said slowly. "I suppose not."
"So, goodbye."
"Goodbye." He gripped my hand hard. Just for a minute, his curious light eyes seemed to burn into mine. Then he turned abruptly and left me. I heard his footsteps ringing along the deck. They echoed and re-echoed. I felt that I should hear them always. Footsteps going out of my life. I can admit frankly that I did not enjoy the next 2 hours. Not till I stood on the wharf, having finished with most of the ridiculous formalities that bureaucracies require, did I breathe freely once more. No arrest had been made, and I realized that it was a heavenly day, and that I was extremely hungry. I joined Suzanne. In any case, I was staying the night with her at the hotel. The boat did not go on to Port Elizabeth in Durban until the following morning. We got into a taxi and drove to the Mount Nelson. It was all heavenly. The sun, the air, the flowers. When I thought of little Hamsey in January, the mud knee-deep, and the sure-to-be-falling rain, I hugged myself with delight. Suzanne was not nearly so enthusiastic. She has travelled a great deal, of course. Besides, she is not the type that gets excited before breakfast. She snubbed me severely when I let out an enthusiastic yelp at the sight of a giant blue convolvulus. By the way, I should like to make clear here and now that this story will not be a story of South Africa. I guarantee no genuine local colour, You know the sort of thing, half a dozen words in italics on every page. I admire it very much, but I can't do it. In South Sea Islands, of course, you make an immediate reference to Bêche de Mer. I don't know what Bêche de Mer is. I've never known. I probably never shall know. I've guessed once or twice and guessed wrong. In South Africa, I know you at once begin to talk about a stoop. I do know what a stoop is. It's a thing round a house, and you sit on it. In various other parts of the world, you call it a veranda, a piazza, and a ha-ha. Then again, there are pawpaws. I had often read of pawpaws. I discovered at once what they were, because I had one plumped down in front of me for breakfast. I thought at first that it was a melon gone bad. The Dutch waitress enlightened me and persuaded me to use lemon juice and sugar and try again. I was very pleased to meet a pawpaw. I had always vaguely associated with the hula hula, which I believe, though I may be wrong, is a kind of straw skirt that Hawaiian girls dance in. No, I think I am wrong. That is a lava lava. At any rate, all these things are very cheering after England. I can't help thinking that it would brighten our cold island life if one could have a breakfast of bacon and then go out clad in a jumper to pay the books. Suzanne was a little tamer after breakfast. They had given me a room next to hers with a lovely view right over Table Bay. I looked at the view whilst Suzanne hunted for some special face cream. When she'd found it and started an immediate application, she became capable of listening to me. "Did you see Sir Eustace?" I asked. "He was marching out of the breakfast room as we went in. He'd had some bad fish or something, and was just telling the head waiter what he thought about it, and he bounced a peach on the floor to show how hard it was. Only it wasn't quite as hard as he thought, and it squashed." Suzanne smiled. "Sir Eustace doesn't like getting up early any more than I do. But Anne, did you see Mr. Paget? I ran against him in the passage. He's got a black eye. What can he have been doing?" "Only trying to push me overboard," I replied nonchalantly. It was a distinct score for me. Suzanne left her face half anointed and pressed for details. I gave them to her. "It all gets more and more mysterious," she cried. "I thought I was going to have the soft job sticking to Sir Eustace, and that you would have all the fun with the Reverend Edward Chichester. But now I'm not so sure. I hope Paget won't push me off the train some dark night." "I think you're still above suspicion, Suzanne. But if the worst happens, I'll wire to Clarence." "That reminds me. Give me a cable form. Let me see now. What shall I say? Implicated in the most thrilling mystery. Please send me £1,000 at once. Suzanne." I took the form from her and pointed out that she could eliminate a the, an a, and possibly, if she didn't care about being polite, a please. Suzanne, however, appears to be perfectly reckless in money matters. Instead of attending to my economical suggestions, she added three more words, "enjoying myself hugely." Suzanne was engaged to lunch with friends of hers, who came to the hotel at about 11 o'clock, to fetch her. I was left to my own devices. I went down through the grounds of the hotel, crossed the tram lines and followed a cool, shady avenue, right down till I came to the main street. I strolled about, seeing the sights, enjoying the sunlight and the sellers of flowers and fruits. I also discovered a place where they had the most delicious ice cream sodas. Finally, I bought a sixpenny basket of peaches and retraced my steps to the hotel. To my surprise and pleasure, I found a note awaiting me. It was from the curator of the museum. He had read of my arrival on the Kilmorden, in which I was described as the daughter of the late Professor Bedingfeld. He had known my father slightly and had had great admiration for him. He went on to say that his wife would be delighted if I would come out and have tea with them that afternoon at their villa at Musenberg. He gave me instructions for getting there. It was pleasant to think that poor Papa was still remembered and highly thought of. I foresaw that I would have to be personally escorted round the museum before I left Cape Town, but I risked that. To most people, it would have been a treat, but one can have too much of a good thing if one is brought up on it morning, noon, and night. I put on my best hat, one of Suzanne's cast-offs, and my least crumpled white linen, and started off after lunch. I caught a fast train to Musenberg and got there in about half an hour. It was a nice trip. We wound slowly round the base of Table Mountain, and some of the flowers were lovely. My geography being weak, I had never fully realised that Cape Town is on a peninsula. Consequently, I was rather surprised on getting out of the train to find myself facing the sea once more. There was some perfectly entrancing bathing going on. The people had short curved boards and came floating in on the waves. It was far too early to go to tea. I made for the bathing pavilion, and when they said, "Would I have a surfboard?" I said, "Yes, please." Surfing looks perfectly easy. It isn't. I say no more. I got very angry and fairly hurled my plank from me. Nevertheless, I determined to return on the first possible opportunity and have another go. I would not be beaten. Quite by mistake, I then got a good run on my board and came out delirious with happiness. Surfing is like that. You're either vigorously cursing or else you're idiotically pleased with yourself. I found the Villa Medgi after some difficulty. It was right up on the side of the mountain, isolated from the other cottages and villas. I rang the bell, and a smiling Kaffir boy answered it. "Mrs. Raffini?" I inquired. He ushered me in, preceded me down the passage, and flung open a door. Just as I was about to pass in, I hesitated. I felt a sudden misgiving. I stepped over the threshold, and the door swung sharply behind me. A man rose from his seat behind a table and came forward with outstretched hand.
"So glad we have persuaded you to visit us, Miss Bedingfeld," he said.
He was a tall man, obviously a Dutchman, with flaming orange beard. He did not look in the least like the curator of a museum. In fact, I realized in a flash that I had made a fool of myself. I was in the hands of the enemy. Chapter 19. It reminded me forcibly of episode 3 in The Perils of Pamela. How often had I not sat in the sixpenny seats, eating a tuppenny bar of milk chocolate and yearning for similar things to happen to me? Well, they had happened with a vengeance, and somehow it was not nearly so amusing as I had imagined. It's all very well on the screen. You have the comfortable knowledge that there's bound to be an episode 4. But in real life, there was absolutely no guarantee that Anna the Adventuress might not terminate abruptly at the end of any episode. Yes, I was in a tight place. All the things that Rayburn had said that morning came back to me with unpleasant distinctness. Tell the truth, he had said. Well, I could always do that. But was it going to help me? To begin with, would my story be believed? Would they consider it likely or possible that I had started off on this mad escapade simply on the strength of a scrap of paper smelling of mothballs? It sounded to me a wildly incredible tale. In that moment of cold sanity, I cursed myself for a melodramatic idiot and yearned for the peaceful boredom of little Hamsley. All this passed through my mind in less time than it takes to tell. My first instinctive moment was to step backwards and feel for the handle of the door. My captor merely grinned.
"Here you are, and here you stay," he remarked facetiously.
I did my best to put a bold face upon the matter. "I was invited to come here by the curator of the Cape Town Museum. If I have made a mistake..."
"A mistake? Oh, yes, a big mistake."
He laughed coarsely. "What right have you to detain me? I shall inform the police."
"Yep, yep, yep, like a little toy dog."
He laughed. I sat down on a chair. "I can only conclude that you are a dangerous lunatic," I said coldly.
"Indeed."
"I should like to point out to you that my friends are perfectly well aware where I have gone, and that if I have not returned by this evening, they will come in search of me. You understand?"
"So your friends know where you are, do they? Which of them?"
Thus challenged, I did a lightning calculation of chances. Should I mention Sir Eustace? He was a well-known man, and his name might carry weight. But if they were in touch with Paget, they might know I was lying. Better not risk Sir Eustace.
"Mrs. Blair, for one," I said lightly,
"a friend of mine with whom I am staying."
"I think not," said the captor, slyly shaking his orange head. "You have not seen her since 11 o'clock this morning, and you received your note bidding you to come here at lunchtime."
His words showed me how closely my movements had been followed. but I was not going to give in without a fight. "You are very clever," I said. "Perhaps you've heard of that useful invention, the telephone? Mrs. Blair called me up on it when I was resting in my room after lunch. I told her then where I was going this afternoon." To my great satisfaction, I saw a shade of uneasiness pass over his face. Clearly he had overlooked the possibility that Suzanne might have telephoned me. I wished he really had done so.
"Enough of this," he said harshly, rising.
"What are you going to do with me?" I asked, still endeavouring to appear composed.
"Put you where you can do no harm in case your friends come after you."
For a moment my blood ran cold, but his next words reassured me.
"Tomorrow you'll have some questions to answer, and after you've answered them, we shall know what to do with you. And I can tell you, young lady, we have more ways than one to make obstinate little fools talk."
It was not cheering, but it was at least a respite. I had until tomorrow. This man was clearly an underling obeying the orders of a superior. Could that superior by any chance be Paget? He called, and two Kaffirs appeared. I was taken upstairs. Despite my struggles, I was gagged and then bound hand and foot. The room into which they had taken me was a kind of attic right under the roof. It was dusty and showed little signs of having been occupied. The Dutchman made a mock bow and withdrew, closing the door behind him. I was quite helpless. Turn and twist as I would, I could not loosen my bonds in the slightest degree, and the gag prevented me from crying out. If by any possible chance anyone did come to the house, I could do nothing to attract their attention. Down below I heard the sound of a door shutting. Evidently the Dutchman was going out. It was maddening not to be able to do anything. I strained again at my bonds, but the knots held. I desisted at last and either fainted or fell asleep. When I awoke I was in pain all over. It was quite dark now and I judged that the night must be well advanced, for the moon was high in the heavens and shining down through the dusty skylight. The gag was half choking me and the stiffness and pain were unendurable. It was then that my eyes fell on a bit of broken glass lying in the corner. A moonbeam slanted right down on it, and its glistening had caught my attention. As I looked at it, an idea came into my head. My arms and legs were helpless, but surely I could still roll. Slowly and awkwardly, I set myself in motion. It was not easy. Besides being extremely painful, since I could not guard my face with my arms, it was also exceedingly difficult to keep any particular direction. I tended to roll in every direction except the one I wanted to go. In the end, however, I came right up against my objective. It almost touched my bound hands. Even then it was not easy. It took an infinity of time before I could wriggle the glass into such a position, wedged against the wall, that it would rub up and down on my bonds. It was a long, heart-rending process, and I almost despaired. But in the end, I succeeded in soaring through the cords that bound my wrists. The rest was a matter of time. Once I had restored the circulation to my hands by rubbing the wrists vigorously, I was able to undo the gag. One or two full breaths did a lot for me. Very soon I'd undone the last knot, though even then it was some time before I could stand on my feet. But at last I stood erect, swinging my arms to and fro to restore the circulation and wishing above all things that I could get hold of something to eat. I waited about a quarter of an hour to be quite sure of my recovered strength. Then I tiptoed noiselessly to the door. As I had hoped, it was not locked, only latched. I unlatched it and peeped cautiously out. Everything was still. The moonlight came in through a window and showed me the dusty, uncarpeted staircase. Cautiously, I crept down it. Still no sound. But as I stood on the landing below, a faint murmur of voices reached me. I stopped dead and stood there for some time. A clock on the wall registered the fact that it was after midnight. I was fully aware of the risks I might run if I descended lower, but my curiosity was too much for me. With infinite precautions, I prepared to explore. I crept softly down the last flight of stairs and stood in the square hall. I looked round me and then caught my breath with a gasp. A Kaffir boy was sitting by the hall door. He had not seen me. Indeed, I soon realized by his breathing that he was fast asleep. Should I retreat or should I go on? The voices came from the room I had been shown into on arrival. One of them was that of my Dutch friend. The other I could not for the moment recognize, though it seemed vaguely familiar. In the end, I decided that it was clearly my duty to hear all I could. I must risk the Kaffir boy waking up. I crossed the hall noiselessly and knelt by the study door. For a moment or two, I could hear no better. The voices were louder, but I could not distinguish what they said. I applied my eye to the keyhole instead of my ear. As I had guessed, one of the speakers was the big Dutchman. The other man was sitting outside my circumscribed range of vision. Suddenly he rose to get himself a drink. His back, black-clad and decorous, came into view. Even before he turned around, I knew who he was. Mr. Chichester. Now I began to make out the words.
All the same, it is dangerous. Suppose her friends come after her.
It was a big man speaking. Chichester answered him. He had dropped his clerical voice entirely. No wonder I had not recognized it.
Oh, bluff. They haven't an idea where she is. She spoke very positively, I dare say. I've looked into the matter and we've nothing to fear. Anyway, it's the colonel's orders. You don't want to go against them, I suppose.
The Dutchman ejaculated something in his own language. I judged it to be a hasty disclaimer.
But why not knock her on the head? He growled. It would be simple. The boat is all ready. She could be taken out to sea.
Yes, said Chichester meditatively. That is what I should do. She knows too much, that is certain. But the colonel is a man who likes to play a lone hand, though no one else must do so. Something in his own words seemed to awaken a memory that annoyed him.
He wants information of some kind from this girl.
He had paused before the information, and the Dutchman was quick to catch him up.
Information?
Something of the kind. Diamonds, I said to myself. And now, continued Chichester, give me the lists. For a long time, their conversation was quite incomprehensible to me. It seemed to deal with large quantities of vegetables. Dates were mentioned, prices and various names of places which I did not know. It was quite half an hour before they had finished their checking and counting. Good, said Chichester, and there was a sound as though he pushed back his chair. I will take these with me for the colonel to see.
When do you leave?
10 o'clock tomorrow morning will do.
Do you want to see the girl before you go?
No. There are strict orders that no one is to see her until the colonel comes. Is she all right?
I looked in on her when I came for dinner. She was asleep, I think. What about food?
A little starvation will do no harm. The colonel will be here some time tomorrow. She will answer questions better if she is hungry. No one had better go near her till then. Is she securely tied up? The Dutchman laughed.
What do you think?
They both laughed. So did I, under my breath. Then, as a sound seemed to betoken that they were about to come out of the room, I beat a hasty retreat. I was just in time. As I reached the head of the stairs, I heard the door of the room open, and at the same time the Kaffir stirred and moved. My retreat by the way of the hall door was not to be thought of. I retired prudently to the attic, gathered my bonds round me, and lay down again on the floor, in case they should take it into their heads to come and look at me. They did not do so, however. After about an hour I crept down the stairs, but the Kaffir by the door was awake and humming softly to himself. I was anxious to get out of the house, but I did not quite see how to manage it. In the end, I was forced to retreat to the attic again. The Kaffir was clearly on guard for the night. I remained there patiently all through the sounds of early morning preparation. The men breakfasted in the hall. I could hear their voices distinctly floating up the stairs. I was getting thoroughly unnerved. How on earth was I to get out of the house? I counseled myself to be patient. A rash move might spoil everything. After breakfast came the sounds of Chichester departing. To my intense relief, the Dutchman accompanied him. I waited breathlessly. Breakfast was being cleared away. The work of the house was being done. At last the various activities seemed to die down. I slipped out from my lair once more. Very carefully I crept down the stairs. The hall was empty. Like a flash I was across it and unlatched the door and was outside in the sunshine. I ran down the drive like one possessed. Once outside I resumed a normal walk. People stared at me curiously, and I do not wonder. My face and clothes must have been covered in dust from rolling about in the attic. At last I came to a garage. I went in. "I have met with an accident," I explained. "I want a car to take me to Cape Town at once. I must catch the boat to Durban." I had not long to wait. 10 minutes later I was speeding along in the direction of Cape Town. I must know if Chichester was on the boat. Whether to sail on her myself or not, I could not determine, but in the end I decided to do so. Chichester would not know that I had seen him in the villa at Musenberg. He would doubtless lay further traps for me, but I was forewarned, and he was the man I was after, the man who was seeking the diamonds on behalf of the mysterious Colonel. Alas for my plans! As I arrived at the docks, the Coolmorden Castle was steaming out to sea, and I had no means of knowing whether Chichester had sailed on her or not. Chapter 20. I drove to the hotel. There was no one in the lounge that I knew. I ran upstairs and tapped on Suzanne's door. Her voice bade me come in. When she saw who it was, she literally fell on my neck. "Anne, dear, where have you been? I've been worried to death about you. What have you been doing?" "Having adventures," I replied. "Episode 3 of The Perils of Pamela." I told her the whole story. She gave vent to a deep sigh when I finished. "Why do these things always happen to you?" she demanded plaintively. "Why does no one gag me and bind me hand and foot?" "You wouldn't like it if they did," I assured her. "To tell you the truth, I'm not nearly so keen on having adventures myself as I was. A little of that sort of thing goes a long way." Suzanne seemed unconvinced. An hour or two of gagging and binding would have changed her view quickly enough. Suzanne likes thrills, but she hates being uncomfortable. "And what are we doing now?" she asked. "I don't quite know," I said thoughtfully. "You still go to Rhodesia, of course, to keep an eye on Paget. And you?" That was just my difficulty. Had Chichester gone on the Coolmorden, or had he not? Did he mean to carry out his original plan of going to Durban? The hour of his leaving Musenberg seemed to point to an affirmative answer to both questions. In that case, I might go to Durban by train. I fancied that I should get there before the boat. On the other hand, if the news of my escape were wired to Chichester, and also the information that I had left Cape Town for Durban, nothing was simpler for him than to leave the boat at either Port Elizabeth or East London, and so give me the slip completely. It was rather a knotty problem. "We'll inquire about trains to Durban anyway," I said. "And it's not too late for morning tea," said Suzanne. "We'll have it in the lounge." The Durban train left at 8:15 that evening, so they told me at the office. For the moment I postponed decision and joined Suzanne for somewhat belated 11 o'clock tea. "Do you feel that you would really recognise Chichester again? In any other disguise, I mean?" asked Suzanne. I shook my head ruefully. "I certainly didn't recognise him as the stewardess, and never should have, but for your drawing." "The man's a professional actor, I'm sure of it," said Suzanne thoughtfully. "His make-up is perfectly marvellous. He might come off the boat as a navvy or something, and you'd never spot him." "You're very cheering," I said. At that minute, Colonel Race stepped in through the window and came and joined us. "What is Sir Eustace doing?" asked Suzanne. "I haven't seen him about today." Rather an odd expression passed over the Colonel's face.
"He's got a little trouble of his own to attend to, which is keeping him busy."
"Tell us about it."
"I mustn't tell tales out of school."
"Tell us something, even if you have to invent it for our special benefit."
"Well, what would you say to the famous man in the brown suit having made the voyage with us?"
"What?" I felt the colour die out of my face and then surge back again. Fortunately, Colonel Race was not looking at me.
"It's a fact, I believe. Every port watched for him, and he bamboozled Pedler into bringing him out as his secretary."
"Not Mr. Paget?"
"Oh, no. Not Paget. The other fellow,
Rayburn, he called himself.
Have they arrested him? Asked Suzanne. Under the table she gave my hand a reassuring squeeze. I waited breathlessly for an answer.
He seems to have disappeared into thin air.
How does Sir Eustace take it?
Regards it as a personal insult offered by fate.
An opportunity of hearing Sir Eustace's views on the matter presented itself later in the day. We were awakened from a refreshing afternoon nap by a page boy with a note. In touching terms, it requested the pleasure of our company at tea in his sitting room. The poor man was indeed in a pitiable state. He poured out his troubles to us, encouraged by Suzanne's sympathetic murmurs. She does that sort of thing very well.
First, a perfectly strange woman has the impertinence to get herself murdered in my house, on purpose to annoy me, I do believe. Why my house? Why, of all the houses in Great Britain, choose the Mill House? What harm have I ever done the woman that she must needs get herself murdered there?
Suzanne made one of her sympathetic noises again, and Sir Eustace proceeded in a still more aggrieved tone.
And if that's not enough, the fellow who murdered her has the impudence, the colossal impudence, to attach himself to me as my secretary. My secretary, if you please. I'm tired of secretaries. I won't have any more secretaries. Either they're concealed murderers or else they're drunken brawlers. Have you seen Paget's black eye? But of course you have. How can I go about with a secretary like that? And his face is such a nasty shade of yellow, too. Just the colour that doesn't go with a black eye. I've done with secretaries. Unless I have a girl. A nice girl with liquid eyes who'll hold my hand when I'm feeling cross. What about you, Miss Anne? Will you take on the job?
How often shall I have to hold your hand? I asked, laughing.
All day long,
replied Sir Eustace gallantly. I shan't get much typing done at that rate, I reminded him.
That doesn't matter. All this work is Paget's idea. He works me to death. I'm looking forward to leaving him behind in Cape Town.
He's staying behind?
Yes. He'll enjoy himself thoroughly sleuthing about after Rayburn. That's the sort of thing that suits Paget down to the ground. He adores intrigue. But I'm quite serious in my offer. Will you come? Mrs. Blair here is a competent chaperone, and you can have half holiday every now and again to dig for bones.
Thank you very much, Sir Eustace, I said cautiously. But I think I'm leaving for Durban tonight.
Now don't be an obstinate girl. Remember, there are lots of lions in Rhodesia. You'll like lions. All girls do.
Will they be practicing low jumps? I asked, laughing. No, thank you very much, but I must go to Durban. Sir Eustace looked at me, sighed deeply, then opened the door of the adjoining room and called to Paget.
If you've quite finished your afternoon sleep, my dear fellow, perhaps you'd do a little work for a change.
Guy Paget appeared in the doorway. He bowed to us both, starting slightly at the sight of me, and replied in a melancholy voice, I have been typing that memorandum all this afternoon, Sir Eustace.
Well, stop typing it then. Go down to the Trade Commissioner's office, or the Board of Agriculture, or the Chamber of Mines, or one of those places, and ask them to lend me some kind of woman to take to Rhodesia. She must have liquid eyes, and not object to my holding her hand.
Yes, Sir Eustace. I will ask for a competent shorthand typist.
Paget's a malicious fellow, said Sir Eustace, after the secretary had departed. I'd be prepared to bet that he'll pick out some slab-faced creature on purpose to annoy me. She must have nice feet, too. I forgot to mention that.
I clutched Suzanne excitedly by the hand and almost dragged her along to her room. Now, Suzanne, I said, we've got to make plans, and make them quickly. Paget is staying behind here. You heard that?
Yes, I suppose that means that I shan't be allowed to go to Rhodesia, which is very annoying,
because I want to go to Rhodesia. How tiresome. Cheer up, I said. You're going all right. I don't see how you could back out at the last moment without its appearing frightfully suspicious. And besides, Paget might suddenly be summoned by Sir Eustace, and it would be far harder for you to attach yourself to him for the journey up.
It would hardly be respectable, said Suzanne, dimpling. I should have to pretend a fatal passion for him as an excuse.
On the other hand, if you were there when he arrived, it would all be perfectly simple and natural. Besides, I don't think we ought to lose sight of the other two entirely. Oh, Anne, you surely don't suspect Colonel Race or Sir Eustace. I suspect everybody, I said darkly. And if you read any detective stories, Suzanne, you must know that it's always the most unlikely person who's the villain. Lots of criminals have been cheerful fat men like Sir Eustace. Colonel Race isn't particularly fat, or particularly cheerful either. Sometimes they're lean and saturnine, I retorted. I don't say I seriously suspect either of them, but, after all, the woman was murdered in Sir Eustace's house. Yes, yes, we needn't go over all that again. I'll watch him for you, Anne, and if he gets any fatter and any more cheerful, I'll send you a telegram at once. Sir E, swelling highly suspicious, come at once. Really, Suzanne, I cried, you seem to think all this is a game. I know I do, said Suzanne, unabashed. It seems like that. It's your fault, Anne. I've got imbued with your let's-have-an-adventure spirit. It doesn't seem a bit real. Dear me, if Clarence knew that I was running about Africa, tracking dangerous criminals, he'd have a fit. Why don't you cable him about it? I asked sarcastically. Suzanne's sense of humour always fails her when it comes to sending cables. She considered my suggestion in perfectly good faith. I might. It would have to be a very long one. Her eyes brightened at the thought. But I think it's better not. Husbands always want to interfere with perfectly harmless amusements. Well, I said, summing up the situation, you keep an eye on Sir Eustace and Colonel Race. I know why I've got to watch Sir Eustace, interrupted Suzanne, because of his figure and his humorous conversation. But I think it's carrying it rather far to suspect Colonel Race. I do indeed. Why, he's something to do with the Secret Service. Do you know, Anne, I believe the best thing we could do would be to confide in him and tell him the whole story. I objected vigorously to this unsporting proposal. I recognised in it the disastrous effects of matrimony. How often have I not heard a perfectly intelligent female say, in the tone of one clinching an argument, Edgar says. And all the time you were perfectly aware that Edgar is a perfect fool. Suzanne, by reason of her married state, was yearning to lean upon some man or other. However, she promised faithfully that she would not breathe a word to Colonel Race, and we went on with our plan-making. It's quite clear that I must stay here and watch Paget, and this is the best way to do it. I must pretend to leave for Durban this evening, take my luggage down and so on, but really I shall go to some small hotel in the town. I can alter my appearance a little, wear a fair toupee and one of those thick white lace veils, and I shall have a much better chance of seeing what he's really like if he thinks I'm safely out of the way. Suzanne approved this plan heartily. We made due and ostentatious preparations, inquiring once more about the departure of the train at the office and packing my luggage. We dined together in the restaurant. Colonel Race did not appear, but Sir Eustace and Paget were at their table in the window. Paget left the table halfway through the meal, which annoyed me, as I had planned to say goodbye to him. However, doubtless Sir Eustace would do as well. I went over to him when I had finished. Goodbye, Sir Eustace, I said. I'm off tonight to Durban. Sir Eustace sighed heavily.
So I heard. You wouldn't like me to come with you, would you?
I should love it.
Nice girl. Sure you won't change your mind and come and look for lions in Rhodesia.
Quite sure.
He must be a very handsome fellow, said Sir Eustace plaintively. Some young whippersnapper in Durban, I suppose, who puts my mature charms completely in the shade. By the way, Paget's going down in the car in a minute or two. He could take you to the station.
Oh, no, thank you, I said hastily. Mrs. Blair and I have got our own taxi ordered. To go down with Guy Paget was the last thing I wanted. Sir Eustace looked at me attentively.
I don't believe you like Paget. I don't blame you. Of all the officious interfering asses going about with the air of a martyr and doing everything he can to annoy and upset me.
What has he done now? I inquired with some curiosity.
He's got hold of a secretary for me. You never saw such a woman. 40, if she's a day, wears pince-nez and sensible boots and an air of brisk efficiency that will be the death of me, a regular slab-faced woman.
Won't she hold your hand?
I devotedly hope not, exclaimed Sir Eustace. That would be the last straw. Well,
Goodbye, Liquid Eyes. If I shoot a lion, I shan't give you the skin, after the base way you've deserted me.
He squeezed my hand warmly and we parted. Suzanne was waiting for me in the hall. She was to come down to see me off. Let's start at once, I said hastily, and motioned to the man to get a taxi. Then a voice behind me made me start.
Excuse me, Miss Bedingfeld, but I am going down in a car. I can drop you and Mrs. Blair at the station.
Oh, thank you, I said hastily, but there's no need to trouble you.
No trouble at all, I assure you. Put the luggage in, porter.
I was helpless. I might have protested further, but a slight warning nudge from Suzanne urged me to be on my guard. Thank you, Mr. Paget, I said coldly. We all got into the car. As we raced down the road into the town, I racked my brains for something to say. In the end, Paget himself broke the silence.
I have secured a very capable secretary for Sir Eustace, he observed. Miss Pettigrew.
He wasn't exactly raving about her just now, I remarked. Paget looked at me coldly.
She is a proficient shorthand typist, he said repressively.
We pulled up in front of the station. Here, surely, he would leave us. I turned with outstretched hand, but no.
I'll come and see you off. It's just 8 o'clock. Your train goes in a quarter of an hour.
He gave efficient directions to porters. I stood helpless, not daring to look at Suzanne. The man suspected. He was determined to make sure that I did go by the train. What could I do? Nothing. I saw myself in a quarter of an hour's time steaming out of the station, with Paget planted on the platform, waving me adieu. He had turned the tables on me adroitly. His manner towards me had changed, moreover. It was full of an uneasy geniality which sat ill upon him and which nauseated me. The man was an oily hypocrite. First he tried to murder me, and now he paid me compliments. Did he imagine for 1 minute that I hadn't recognised him that night on the boat? No, it was a pose which he forced me to acquiesce in, his tongue in his cheek all the while. Helpless as a sheep, I moved along under his expert directions. My luggage was piled in my sleeping compartment. I had a 2-berth one to myself. It was 8:12. In 3 minutes, the train would start. But Paget had reckoned without Suzanne. It will be a terribly hot journey, Anne, she said suddenly, especially going through the Karoo tomorrow. You've got some eau de cologne or lavender water with you, haven't you? My cue was plain. Oh, dear, I cried. I left my eau de cologne on the dressing table at the hotel. Suzanne's habit of command served her well. She turned imperiously to Paget. Mr. Paget, quick, you've just time. There's a chemist almost opposite the station. Anne must have eau de cologne. He hesitated. But Suzanne's imperative manner was too much for him. She is a born autocrat. He went. Suzanne followed him with her eyes till he disappeared. Quick, Anne, get out the other side, in case he hasn't really gone, but is watching us from the end of the platform. Never mind your luggage. We can telegraph about that tomorrow. Oh, if only the train starts on time. I opened the gate on the opposite side to the platform and climbed down. Nobody was observing me. I could just see Suzanne standing where I had left her, looking up at the train and apparently chatting to me at the window. A whistle blew. The train began to draw out. Then I heard feet racing furiously up the platform. I withdrew to the shadow of my friendly bookstall and watched. Suzanne turned from waving her handkerchief to the retreating train. "Too late, Mr. Paget," she said cheerfully. "She's gone. Is that the eau de cologne? What a pity we didn't think of it sooner." They passed not far from me on their way out of the station. Guy Paget was extremely hot. He had evidently run all the way to the chemist and back.
"Shall I get you a taxi, Mrs. Blair?"
Suzanne did not fail in her role. "Yes, please. Can I give you a lift back? Have you much to do for Sir Eustace? Dear me, I wish Anne Bedingfeld was coming with us tomorrow. I don't like the idea of a young girl like that travelling off to Durban all by herself." But she was set upon it. Some little attraction there, I fancy. They passed out of earshot. Clever Suzanne. She had saved me. I allowed a minute or two to elapse, and then I too made my way out of the station, almost colliding as I did so with a man. An unpleasant-looking man, with a nose disproportionately big for his face. Chapter 21 I had no further difficulty in carrying out my plans. I found a small hotel in a back street, got a room there, paid a deposit as I had no luggage with me, and went placidly to bed. On the following morning, I was up early and went out into the town to purchase a modest wardrobe. My idea was to do nothing until after the departure of the 11 o'clock train to Rhodesia with most of the party on board. Paget was not likely to indulge in any nefarious activities until he had got rid of them. Accordingly, I took a train out of the town and proceeded to enjoy a country walk. It was comparatively cool, and I was glad to stretch my legs after the long voyage and my close confinement at Muizenberg. A lot hinges on small things. My shoelace came untied, and I stopped to do it up. The road had just turned a corner, and as I was bending over the offending shoe, a man came right round and almost walked into me. He lifted his hat, murmuring an apology, and went on. It struck me at the time that his face was vaguely familiar, but at the moment I thought no more of it. I looked at my wristwatch. The time was getting on. I turned my feet in the direction of Cape Town. There was a tram on the point of going, and I had to run for it. I heard other footsteps running behind me. I swung myself on, and so did the other runner. I recognized him at once. It was the man who'd passed me on the road when my shoe came untied. And in a flash, I knew why his face was familiar. It was the small man with the big nose, whom I had run into leaving the station the night before. The coincidence was rather startling. Could it be possible that the man was deliberately following me? I resolved to test that as promptly as possible. I rang the bell and got off at the next stop. The man did not get off. I withdrew into the shadow of a shop doorway and watched. He alighted at the next stop and walked back in my direction. The case was clear enough. I was being followed. I had crowed too soon. My victory over Guy Paget took on another aspect. I hailed the next tram, and as I expected, my shadower also got on. I gave myself up to some very serious thinking. It was perfectly apparent that I had stumbled on a bigger thing than I knew. The murder in the house at Marlow was not an isolated incident committed by a solitary individual. I was up against a gang, and thanks to Colonel Race's revelations to Suzanne and what I had overheard at the house at Muizenberg, I was beginning to understand some of its manifold activities. Systemized crime, organized by the man known to his followers as the Colonel. I remembered some of the talk I had heard on board ship, of the strike on the Rand and the causes underlying it, and the belief that some secret organization was at work fomenting the agitation. That was the Colonel's work. His emissaries were acting according to plan. He took no part in these things himself, I had always heard, as he limited himself to directing and organizing. The brain work, not the dangerous labor for him. But still, it well might be that he himself was on the spot, directing affairs from an apparently impeccable position. That, then, was the meaning of Colonel Race's presence on the Kilmorden Castle. He was out after the arch-criminal. Everything fitted in with that assumption. He was someone high up in the Secret Service, whose business it was to lay the Colonel by the heels. I nodded to myself. Things were becoming very clear to me. What of my part in the affair? Where did I come in? Was it only diamonds they were after? I shook my head. Great as the value of the diamonds might be, they hardly accounted for the desperate attempts which had been made to get me out of the way. No, I stood for more than that. In some way, unknown to myself, I was a menace, a danger. Some knowledge that I had, or that they thought I had, made them anxious to remove me at all costs, and that knowledge was bound up somehow with the diamonds. There was one person, I felt sure, who could enlighten me, if he would. The man in the brown suit, Harry Raeburn. He knew the other half of the story, but he had vanished into the darkness. He was a hunted creature, flying from pursuit. In all probability, he and I would never meet again. I brought myself back with a jerk to the actualities of the moment. It was no good thinking sentimentally of Harry Raeburn. He had displayed the greatest antipathy to me from the first. Or at least, there I was again, dreaming. The real problem was what to do now. I prided myself upon my role of watcher and had become the watched, and I was afraid. For the first time I began to lose my nerve. I was the little bit of grit that was impeding the smooth working of the great machine, and I fancied that the machine would have a short way with little bits of grit. Once Harry Rayburn had saved me, once I had saved myself, but I felt suddenly that the odds were heavily against me. My enemies were all around me in every direction, and they were closing in. If I continued to play a lone hand, I was doomed. I rallied myself with an effort. After all, what could they do? I was in a civilized city, with policemen every few yards. I would be wary in future. They would not trap me again as they had done in Moisenberg. As I reached this point in my meditations, the tram arrived at Adderley Street. I got out, undecided what to do. I walked slowly up the left-hand side of the street. I did not trouble to look if my watcher was behind me. I knew he was. I walked into Cartwright's and ordered 2 coffee ice cream sodas to steady my nerves. A man, I suppose, would have had a stiff peg, but girls derive a lot of comfort from ice cream sodas. I applied myself to the end of the straw with gusto. The cool liquid was trickling down my throat in the most agreeable manner. I pushed the first glass aside empty. I was sitting on one of the little high stools in front of the counter. Out of the tail of my eye, I saw my tracker come in and sit down unostentatiously at a little table near the door. I finished the second coffee soda and demanded a maple one. I can drink